the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest on the program today is Tana Cleaves, who is going to speak to us about the importance of picking successor trustees. If you have a trust, it's not just enough to form a trust. You should also be careful about who the successor trustees are and how picking them carefully can avoid a lot of elder abuse when it comes to finances.
But on today's show, we're going to talk about numbers. Now, relax. We're not going to be doing a lot of math. This is, after all, a podcast. It's not a classroom. But what I want to do is, you know, we've talked about knowing a number when you get to retirement. But there's really several type of numbers that you need leading up to retirement. For example, and I'm going to break it down and make it easy. Number one. What is your marginal tax bracket? Folks, it makes a big difference when you're saving for retirement if you can cut down on the amount of taxes that you pay on your investments, because those investments are taxed at your highest bracket. So we'll be talking about the first number you need to know is your marginal tax bracket if you're saving for retirement. Number two, what is your budget for retirement? Because everybody says, well, you need to know your number. Your number depends on what your expenses are going to be. And I guarantee you, your expenses in retirement are going to look a whole lot different than what they are raising a family or working. Number three is, what is the amount of money that you're going to need to make retirement happen? And number four, and this is one that most people don't think about, the three different phases of retirement. Phase one could be somebody that retires early, before age 59 and a half, when they can tap into pension funds, or 5 or 6 years prior to retirement. What are the things that you need to get in place so when that day comes, whether it's a decision you make on your own, or it's a decision that's made for you with maybe downsizing, that you know that's what we call phase one, because there are a lot of things you don't have access to during that phase one process. Phase two is usually when you get to at least 59 and a half, you can tap into pension funds without penalties or having to annuitize. And usually phase three is age 66 and after, when you get full retirement benefits from Social Security. Now, knowing these numbers may determine, number one, if you're going to be able to retire. Two, when will you be able to retire? Three, whether you stay and remain retired. There are a lot of retirees right now, because of low interest rates or bad investments, are finding themselves they have to go back to work. And number four, go broke. Yes, we're seeing some people. In fact, we're seeing a lot of situations today where parents are moving in with their kids because they simply don't have the money.
Wow, you've got my attention now. This is becoming interesting. Kids are still living with their parents, parents moving back in with their kids. This could be a little house on the prairie all over again, you know?
Welcome to the new dynamics of financial repression, because that's exactly what we're seeing, John.
Yeah, maybe you should call it the dynamics, because I don't think anybody wants to think of dying broke. You know, as you said, this is not a lot of math. But that was a lot of numbers that went roaring by here. So let's see if we can make some sense of this for people and then put it all together. It's not as bad as it seems. You just have to lay it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like a roadmap. You're at point A and you want to go up to point B. Let's say I'm in San Diego. I want to drive up to San Francisco. I'm going to look at a map and there are certain highways I'm going to have to get on to make my trip happen. And it's the same premise. When you start with, let's say you're not retired, so what are you doing? You are saving up and putting money aside, hopefully, so you will be able to retire. In the first number, as I talked about, there are four numbers that you need to know, is your marginal tax bracket. Now, for those of you that have filed your tax return, I'm going to give you a simple line item. Go to the back page of the first page of your tax return. It's called taxable income. It's actually line number 43 on your tax number. When you get that number, that is your taxable income. You can go to the tax tables and it's going to tell you what marginal tax bracket you're in. And the reason you need to know that number, because what that's telling you is if you make one more dollar of interest one more dollar of salary, it's going to tell you at what rate that new dollar will be taxed at. And for those of you that are saving for retirement, what you want to do is minimize your taxes on your investments, because the top tax rate today, depending on what your level of income, is 44% at the federal level. By the time you add the Clinton tax rates, the phase out of deductions with the Pease Amendment, and then you add Obamacare taxes, you can get up to 44%. And here in California, add another 13, you're talking 57%. You do not want to have your investment income taxed at 57%. It's going to take you that much longer to get the money that you want to retire. So if you can do your savings or investing in a tax-efficient manner, the more taxes that you save, the more dollars you have in your pocket that are accumulating for retirement.
So if we're talking about efficient saving for retirement, obviously we have discussed on our weekend program, Financial Sense NewsHour, the fact that we've been in a zero interest rate environment, which means certain types of savings are very difficult to get anything on. You have to be able to save efficiently and also in an efficient tax environment, so what you're saving doesn't get wiped out by the taxes. So how do you minimize the taxes when putting away dollars?
Well, I mean, for most of our listeners, they're probably employees, either in the private sector or the public sector. And if you're putting money away, the most efficient way to do it is to put money in your employer pension plan. Maybe it's a 401k if you're in a public company. In the private sector, in the public sector, it might be a 403b or let's say a 457 plan. Because number one, the money that you put into that 401k, it's a tax deduction right off the top. It reduces your gross income. And effectively, let's say you're in a 40% bracket and you put $10,000 in a 401k program, essentially you're saving $4,000. So of that $10,000, really, the government's contributing $4,000, the amount that you would pay the government if you didn't put that money in a pension plan. So you get a tax deduction off the top. Secondly, any earnings, whether interest or dividends or capital gains on that investment, are tax deferred until you start to draw them out when you retire. And in many corporations, you get matching contributions. You get 100% contribution. I know many companies that match, I think, the first 6% you put of your pay into a 401k program, they're going to match it dollar for dollar. So that's like getting 100% return on every new dollar that you put into your pension plan the first year. So there are a number of reasons why this is probably one of the most efficient things you can do when saving for retirement.
Well, under those terms, then, using a pension plan seems fairly obvious. Most Americans are using either like a 401k, a 403b, 454 plans. But what about outside pension plans? Is there anything that you could invest in that might be, say, for example, tax-free, tax-deferred, or tax-sheltered for that matter?
Yeah, my favorites in terms of investing outside of a pension plan are tax-sheltered, tax-deferral, and lower taxation. I mean, real estate, you can't get excess deductions to offset your regular income, but you can have the income or rents that you receive from real estate, you can have them partially sheltered through depreciation and expenses. There are stocks, or what we know as master limited partnerships or royalty trust, where you can get 5 to 7 returns and have maybe anywhere from 60 to 70% of those dividends sheltered. I also like dividends. This is something that, you know, a lot of people have stayed away from the stock market, but folks, you know, if you're in the Bush tax bracket, your dividends are taxed at 15% versus the average individual who's probably in a 30% bracket or as high as 44%. And if you have your own private business and you're a C corporation, if you invest in high dividend paying stocks, almost 80% of those dividends, or I think it's 70%, is exempt from federal taxes. So you need to think like Warren Buffett. I mean, everybody knows Buffett is a very shrewd and smart stock picker, but he's probably one of the shrewdest businessmen I know when it comes to paying taxes. He keeps all of his income at a 20% tax bracket. That's why Buffett has amassed a large amount of capital. Berkshire Hathaway is his own personal tax shelter. And I want to illustrate a point. Let's say that you have $10,000 a year of investment income coming in from your investments. If you're in a 40% bracket, you're paying out of that $10,000, $4,000 in taxes. Or if you're in a 20% bracket, you're only paying $2,000 out of that $10,000. Now, You may not think that's much, but let's say you're reinvesting that $10,000 after tax. Well, if you're in a 40% bracket over 10 years, if you're putting in $6,000 a year, which is what you would have after taxes, it would grow to about $128,000 in 20 years, and then $95,000 in 10 years. You take a look at if you were doing it in a 20% bracket, meaning you were saving $8,000 because you paid half the amount of taxes, you would have $458,000 in 20 years versus what you would have in another bracket. So it makes a major, major difference if you can cut down on the amount of taxes that you're paying on your investments. It's plain and simple. It's more money in your pocket. It's more money that you're going to invest.
So you can see a significant difference if you want to minimize your taxes. Warren Buffett's strategy was to keep investments taxed at lower brackets and rates. Let's move on to the second number, a retirement budget. And this may become a fluid thing. You have to plan it today, but understand that there will be changes in the future, some of which you can possibly anticipate as you're planning today, others possibly not.
Yeah, because this really drives the investment number when people say, well, how much dollars will I need saved up by the time I retire? A lot of that, folks, is going to depend on what your budget is. And you need to sit down and take a look at where you're spending money now. Maybe you have a house payment. Maybe when you retire, you will pay cash for a home. You downsize, you move to another state where there's no income taxes. I know a lot of people on the East Coast move down to Florida where there's no income taxes, or even Texas. And, you know, they sell the big home that they raise the family in. They take some of that equity. They pay cash for a smaller home. So their budget is going to look much different when they retire. They may not have to have updated cars. Maybe they get down to one car. They're going to be doing more traveling. They're going to have more time for leisure. So when you think about retirement, you need to really think of, you know, what is it going to cost me to live when I'm retired? You don't want to retire and then have to discover this. And this is the number that drives another number, which is how much do I need to have in assets when I retire to provide the income I'm going to need to provide me throughout retirement. And remember, the expenses are different. You're going to live differently. Most people will end up living in a smaller home. Many people will end up living in a different state. There's different tax consequences. There's different estate tax consequences. But mainly, take a look at what the living expenses are going to be. They're probably going to be cheaper in Florida than they are in New York or New Jersey. And you have to think this through because it really tells you what your next number is. And if you don't know what your living expenses are going to be in retirement, then how are you really going to know how much money you're going to have saved up to get you to retirement so you will feel comfortable and not have to end up going back to work or end up going broke later on in your retirement years, which is something we're seeing more and more people do.
So we're on the way to planning a budget, which you have to come up with. You have to know what your living expenses are most likely to be and probably do some projection of that into the future, knowing that inflation is going to be a factor sooner or later and other issues. Now, what about the next number, what it needs to be? How big does it have to be? And I'm assuming that's the one where we look at what your income level has to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the easiest number to come up with. I mean, once you know what your budget is, you know, you're going to retire on $50,000 a year, 60, 70, 80, or 100, whatever that number is. Then what you do is you take that number and you subtract things that you know that are predictable. You know, maybe you have a pension or one spouse has a pension. You know what your Social Security is. And you subtract that from your expenses. And then what's left over is that's what you're going to have to provide through your investments, that shortfall. Then you know how much you're going to need to save. I mean, it's a simple mathematical calculation. You take what the rates of return are, and then you just back into it and say, well, if I need, let's say, $40,000 to come in or $30,000 to come in from my investments, you know, it's pretty easy to predict how much you're going to have by the time you retire. And the problem, John, as you referred to, in this zero interest rate environment that we operate now, returns aren't what most people thought they are. There are a lot of investors still sitting in cash and bonds, or even worse, gold. They're getting no cash flow. Their investments aren't big enough to provide the capital or build the amount of capital that they're going to need. We're in a low return environment. And a lot of people just simply aren't going to make their numbers. Others who are retired are finding themselves working part-time. They're going to have to downsize. I've come across several situations where we've had to redo, sell the house here in California, move to another state where the cost of living was much cheaper and free up some capital that was tied up in the equity of a home and also reduce tax rates and living expenses. But, you know, as far as knowing what that number is, it's really predicated, folks, on what your expenses are going to be in retirement. And then once you know that number, you just basically subtract the predictables, the pension, the Social Security, and you arrive at the shortfall. And that shortfall is pretty easy to calculate what kind of assets you're going to need to produce that kind of income.
So having talked about saving in a tax-efficient manner that gets you more dollars in your pocket and thereby more money to compound into earning for savings at retirement, you need a retirement budget. This tells you what you need to have saved up versus what you're going to have to be spending on a regular basis. But now what about retirement itself? Because there are always those unanticipated issues. We know that people are living longer, for example, so therefore the dollars have to last longer. This week's guest talks about medical expenses becoming a bigger burden in the future. You know, you could see a point whereby unforeseeable medical expenses could wipe out your retirement and your nest egg and even the house you're living in.
Yeah, I mean, most people, when they're thinking about retirement, they think, okay, retirement, it's kind of like an all-inclusive time period. Folks, you need to think about your retirement. We'll have 2 to 3 phases in it. Phase one could be pre-retirement, 5, 6, 8 years prior to your actual retirement date. Or it could be you retire early, let's say in your 40s or late 40s or 50s. I've had clients that have retired actually in their late 40s and some in their 50s, where you don't have access to your retirement programs without annuitizing or paying a penalty. So that's what we call phase one of retirement, and that's the pre-retirement phase or early retirement phase. Phase two is when you actually have access to your retirement funds without penalty, without annuitization. That begins at age 59 and a half. And then phase three is what we call full retirement availability for Social Security. And for most boomers out there right now, that's age 66. And what you really want to do is start thinking of your retirement in these phases, because phase one, either early retirement or getting ready for retirement, you're going to want to make your investments a little bit more conservative. Maybe you go from, you know, small cap stocks to large cap stocks, maybe add a fixed income component to your portfolio. And it's time to tone down the level of risk. And what I'm afraid of is so many people have been in cash or in bond funds that as this bull market continues, they're going to start rolling the dice in the final phase of the market when it starts to get crazy. If you retire early, consider, you know, maybe part-time work so you don't have to draw down as much on your assets. And if you can, defer tapping or drawing down your investments. The longer you allow them to accumulate, the bigger the nest egg that you're going to have that will last you longer in retirement, especially if you retire early. You have to make those dollars last a longer period of time. And what you're doing in pre-retirement, folks, you need to start thinking about what you're doing investment-wise. If you've been sitting in cash or everything's in a bond fund, that is not a wise choice. You know, with treasuries at 2.6% on a 10-year treasury note, how in the heck are you going to accumulate enough assets to last you 25, 30 years throughout your retirement years?
Okay, what about tapping into pensions and maybe Social Security? Now, those sources are a lot more predictable than investments. But when you're doing that, you also have to understand the rules that govern these various accounts. You have to know the penalties with pensions, IRAs at ages below 59 and a half years of age. What do you do so you don't have to access any of those plans before the appropriate age?
Well, I mean, if you retire early, consider working part-time to supplement your income. Because what you really want to do is avoid annuitization, which is a way that allows you to access your retirement funds early without paying the penalty. So we have found the best approach, John, has been to work part-time or get some kind of income. And you might be able to do something that you maybe wanted to do, something different than in your working career. The second phase is when you are at least 59 and a half, age 60, you now have access to your retirement funds at age 59 and a half. But you do have a 6-year gap between age 60 and 66 when you have full access to Social Security without any penalties. And really, you really want to wait to age 66 because you're going to pay a penalty if you take it early. And, you know, the longer you wait, the bigger those Social Security benefits get. And I can't tell you, folks, in this kind of low interest rate environment, how much equivalent additional assets that equates to. So at age 66, at that point, you could even work part-time and not worry about losing your Social Security benefits. You don't lose a dime like back in the old days when they used to phase it out. So once you reach age 66, full retirement age, that is the final stage. There are no drawbacks. At this stage, you need to think of increasing medical expenses that you're more likely to run into in your 70s, and you need to have investments. I don't care if it's rental real estate or blue chip stocks that are going to increase the income every single year, because how are you going to face those additional medical expenses, which we'll be even talking about now, that's been impacted by Obamacare, because your medical expenses are going to go up. In the final phase of retirement, you are likely to face one of two possible scenarios. Number one, higher medical expenses, or number two, one of you ends up in a managed care facility. Now you're maintaining two households. You're maintaining a managed care where the sick spouse or the one that needs assisted care lives, and then the well spouse living in their home. So you need to have a growing source of income. And if you don't, you need to think about yourself. Do you really want to start dipping into principal? What if one spouse gets sick, goes into a retirement home? You have no long-term care insurance. Now you're drawing down principal to pay the expenses. Think of the condition that leaves the surviving spouse in. So you need to think of your retirement in three different phases, and you need to have an investment plan and financial plan to handle each one of those phases, because you're going to run into different expenses and a different environment.
You know, we started out by saying it's not that hard, but it's beginning to look a little harder than maybe it seemed at the beginning. How do you deal with all of these issues? I mean, when you're, say, for example, dealing with clients or working out a plan, there are a lot of issues here to confront. You have laws, you have taxes, markets, headline news, budgets, etc.
Well, I mean, fortunately, many of our clients we deal with, we start out with a financial plan. We have state-of-the-art software that lays out the probabilities of success. And the first thing you look at is, will they be successful? In other words, do they have enough assets given where their expenses are going to be, their lifestyle? And it's one of the first things we look at in the financial plan. There is a gauge. We run a Monte Carlo simulation that talks about, you know, scenarios with a bear market. What will that impact do to assets? Will there still be enough assets there? And it's kind of like, that's one of the first things I look at in a plan. It's kind of like a doctor. You go in for a physical. What's the doctor going to look at first? He's going to look at your blood work. And so, you know, if I see a 90% probability, I know that, you know, we're in pretty good shape asset-wise, expense-wise. If we're less than 90%, then we need to start thinking about alternatives. And John, everybody's a little bit different. A retirement plan has to fit the individual. They have to have the input. If you're suggesting something they're not comfortable with, well, it's not going to work. So the client has the largest input into the process. What we try to do is, when we don't have 90% probability of success, then we have to start thinking outside the box. We look at alternatives. And then we present those alternatives to the client, so the client could say, I don't like alternative A. That doesn't really work for us. Not comfortable with that. You know, maybe a combination of alternative B and C. So at the end of the day, the plan has to be the client's plan. It has to fit them personally. Otherwise, quite honestly, they're not going to implement it. It's not going to work. And there's so many ways you can solve a problem today. But more importantly, the individual has to be in charge of that process, because, you know, it's their plan, it's their life, it's their retirement. And, you know, really what our job is just to show them what the alternatives are.
Okay, let's put today's lesson perspective into action. Time to discuss the lesson with a case study. And to illustrate today's key concept, we'll talk about the two Johnsons. This is a real case study, but of course we've changed the names to protect the actual people.
Well, this is a case. Mike Johnson, age 55 when he came in to see us. His wife, Nancy, age 49. Mike was a marketing manager for a consumer products company. With the kids basically in college, Nancy worked in sales at Nordstrom. Two kids, sophomore in college and one a senior in high school. that was basically talking about going into the military. Their tax bracket was 33% federal and 7% state. So their combined tax bracket was about 40%. Now, they've done well. Mike makes a very good six-figure income in their assets, mainly $270,000 in cash. A lot of that had to come from liquidating assets during a market downturn and plus additional savings. Combination Mike's 401k with matching contributions at this point was about $800,000. IRAs between the two of them, close to $150,000. Their home was about $1.3 million. And Nancy had inherited $500,000 when her mom passed away. And so that was one of the reasons that kind of prompted the plan, because all of a sudden here was a big chunk of capital. So, I mean, they're in a pretty good situation. I mean, they had almost $3 million worth of assets with only about $400,000 worth of liabilities. Now, here was the plan, was to sell the home in New Jersey and retire at age 60 and buy one in Florida. And so the retirement plan was, when they came in to see us, they were about 5 years away from retirement, as many people on the East Coast do. You know, it's much easier to leave a high tax, high expense, high living area and go down to Florida where you have no income taxes. And when we went through the process, they took a look at, well, one of the things they planned on doing is taking some of the equity out of their home. And part of the plan was to go down to Florida, buy something for in the neighborhood of about $400,000. They could live in a really nice home, paid for, so no mortgage payments, free and clear. And their budget was roughly about $70,000 in fixed expenses, they figured, when they retired, and maybe $20,000 a year in travel expenses. So the real question was, would this work at age 60?
Well, it seems like with, you know, $3 million in assets, that would be more than adequate. But like many Americans, depending on what tax bracket you're in, you have a 40% tax rate. So at age 60, was that really a doable thing?
You know, if you take a look at age 55, they had close to, between Mike's 401k program, their IRAs, they had about $950,000 in pension. They got Nancy's $500,000 inheritance. And the idea was, when they sold their home in Florida, they've been down there, they vacationed down there, they thought they could live and find a house very comfortably for about $400,000, which would free up roughly about $500,000 of equity out of their home. So they'd have roughly $2 million of assets, $270,000, but remember, they're still working. And the problem is the $270,000 in assets was earning less than 1%. At least they had it in bank CDs rather than a money market fund. The second thing is their tax bracket was 40%. That was 33 federal, 7 state. And they were saving roughly about $40,000 a year. Now, part of that was going into Mike's 401k program, where he had matching contributions from the company. Now, it was assumed in the plan that the rate of return would be between 6 and 7%. So another 5 years of putting 40 grand a year away in savings, plus the accumulation of existing assets, they'd have roughly about $2.6 million when they retired, plus pulling out another $500,000 of equity out of their home when they sold that and then eventually moved down to Florida and pay cash. So at retirement, John, they were going to have a little over $3 million. So the plan was, in phase one, Mike was not using the extra accelerated contribution in his 401k program. Once you're over 50, you can put in a catch-up clause, an additional $5,000. So we urged him to add another $5,000 because it came right off the top of that $5,000. He was saving $2,000 in taxes just by doing that. The other thing is, with the cash and inheritance, we recommended blue chip dividend paying stocks because they were in a tax bracket where the dividends were going to be taxed at 15% versus 33% tax on interest. And so it was, you know, 40% of the tax rate. And the retirement assets, we wanted him to shift to roughly 70% blue chip type stocks with about 30% bonds. And we did that in his 401k program. Unfortunately, he couldn't do individual bonds, but we had short maturity bond funds to reduce some of the volatility, reduce some of the risk in the portfolio. And then with the personal assets, we mainly did dividend paying stocks because they were going to be taxed at 15%.
Let me interrupt you here for just a second, Jim. What about muni bonds? I mean, how come you didn't look at that? I mean, especially given his bracket.
Well, I mean, yeah, in a 40% bracket. The problem is, you know, with the munis in the area, we could only get 3% and that'd be going out 10 years. It just didn't look attractive. You know, we could get over 3% in dividend paying stocks taxed at only 15%. Heck, I could get utilities, master limited partnerships, royalty trust, and make a lot more money after tax and have that source grow. Because remember, what we wanted to do to make this plan work is accumulate as much assets as we could at the time of retirement, because we had the second phase of their retirement, which was going to be between age 60 and 66 when they could start tapping into Social Security. The other thing that we talked to them about, I go, look, real estate market's going very well. You don't need the big house now. You may want to consider in the next couple of years selling the house, buying the house in Florida right now or in the next couple of years, pay cash for it, turn it into a rental to earn some extra income, which you can shelter with depreciation until you get to retirement. Because I don't know 5 years from now if the real estate market is going to be where it is today. And everybody recalls what happened to real estate between 2007 and 2011. So part of the plan was to sell the big house that they're living in now a couple of years prior to retirement. Now, phase two was to move to Florida, where they would save immediately 7% in state income taxes. They would drop to a 15% tax rate at retirement, not only on dividends, but also on the personal income they could tap into in their IRA, and the dividends would be taxed at 15%. Phase three was at age 66 when Mike's Social Security would kick in, which was going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $26,000, $27,000. And then eventually, a couple of years later, Nancy would be getting her Social Security. So, I mean, this was really a good plan. But what we were doing is setting the plan in place 5 years prior to retirement, getting the ducks in the row, minimizing taxes, accelerating some of the money put into the 401k program, making the investment income taxed at 15% versus 30%, and then also probably putting the house up for sale a couple of years prior to the move down to Florida, lock in the price of the home, pay cash for it, maybe turn it into a rental. But here, what we were doing, John, is making his investment income tax efficient and putting in place a plan so maybe he doesn't make it to age 60. You know, maybe the company downsizes, we go into a recession. But we had a plan in place for each phase of their retirement where we'd have access or tap into different sources of income. The IRA at age 60 and then Social Security at age 66.
So what you did here was you took into account all three phases of retirement planning. You moved his investment income from a 30% to a 15% bracket. Also, a greater deduction on the taxes by moving more money into a 401k plan. So it looked like you moved right into phase one of retirement pretty smoothly.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about having a plan, because we had structures in place, we had a plan, we were taking advantage of lowering their taxes, and then on top of that, you know, we were putting a plan in motion. So there was step one, step two, and they also knew that, okay, when they retire, which would be phase two at age 60, they knew exactly where their income was going to come from, they knew where they were going to live, they would have a house, they would take the equity out of their existing house, that would be working for them, and then, of course, at age 66, they would have access to Mike's Social Security, and 4 years later to Nancy's Social Security, you know, when Mike got close to age 70. So those additional expenses that you might anticipate in phase three of retirement, medical expenses or long-term care, there was ample assets and income to take care of each one of those phases.
And Jim, if people would like more information or contact you about retirement planning, there must be a number that which they can do that.
If you would like to put together your retirement plan, you can reach us at 888-486-3939, and we can talk to you about putting together your own personal retirement plan.
Coming up next is Tana Cleaves, who will discuss with us the importance of picking successor trustees for your trust, and not just anyone. Whom you pick is very important because it helps avoid the prospect of elderly financial abuse. Coming up next here on Lifetime Income at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
couple of years ago, Congress settled the estate planning issue. We now know what the exemptions are and what the tax rates are. But planning an estate is more than that. There's succession, there's the passing of assets, the transfer, or even managing assets for an elder spouse or surviving spouse. Joining us on the program is Tana Cleese from Pro Fiduciary. And Tana, I can remember when we used to do living trust back in the 80s, it was just coming into play. The exemptions were much lower. The tax rates were much higher. Over the years, the exemption has gone up. And we've seen a lot of people think, well, I don't have to do anything now because we don't have to face estate taxes with the exemption at roughly $5,350,000. But there's other issues involved in estate planning, and that is taking care of siblings, keeping family peace, all the complexities that go into settling an estate, from appraisals to tax distributions. Let's talk about why a person would want to consider a successor trustee.
Well, one reason you want to consider a successor trustee is when the two trustors have passed away, someone needs to carry out the duties of the trust. So whether that be to distribute the estate outright or continue in trust for the benefit of a beneficiary, someone needs to be performing those duties. A reliable person that's experienced in that area and knows the ins and outs. And you need to decide who that person's going to be while you can to perform those duties.
Some of these things are complex. Now, a lot of individuals have thought, well, you know, we don't have a $5 million estate. When somebody passes away, do you have to file a 706 return if your assets are underneath the amount that would be subject to taxes?
No, you do not need to. But you still have other tax returns you need to be mindful of. For example, final lifetime income tax return needs to be done. Also, a fiduciary tax return, which is a trust tax return, needs to be completed.
And what is the time frame for doing that? And I want to talk about issues when there are estate planning taxes. And I want to get into some issues regarding trust today where, for example, the typical trust that were done for a number of years were what we call the AB trust, where the assets would split in two. But is that necessary today when you have a situation where you don't have assets subject to estate taxes?
No, it's not something that's necessary. A lot of attorneys nowadays are advising their clients to consider what's called a disclaimer trust. And what a disclaimer trust is, it says that when the first spouse passes away, the second spouse can either opt to split the trust into an AB or keep it as one trust, which eliminates some of the extra paperwork and things that need to be done with two trusts versus just the one.
Now, one of the issues that sometimes we often face in estate planning, Tana, is that you may have a married couple where the husband was the breadwinner, or in other issues, he was the main financial decision maker. Husband passes away usually because women outlive men. Now the surviving spouse is having to deal with issues of finances and investment decisions where she may have not participated in those decisions in the past. And a lot of times families will rely on children to take over those issues. Let's talk about the problems that are created when this approach is adopted as a estate planning solution.
Yes, as a successor trustee, the trustors can determine if they want it to be a family member for a successor trustee, which is very common, or a professional trustee. And when you name a family member, a lot of times that role is very intense for that particular person that's relied upon to, for example, pay the bills for mom, make sure all of the 1099s are to the accountant for the tax returns. So that role becomes very burdensome and very time-consuming for the child. And a lot of times they feel all those financial decisions are on their back versus the other sibling or a professional trustee. So it can become very overwhelming for both the surviving spouse and the child that's performing that role.
You know, we've recently come across two issues, and this is something you didn't see or hear too much about this, let's say a couple decades ago, and that is spousal abuse or elder abuse. And we had a situation where one son out of four children was appointed as trustee. He decided that he would pay himself a salary of $5,000 a month, taking a good majority of his mother's income to support himself and also using some of the assets for purchasing things for his own benefit, with the other children not being aware of this. Let's talk about the issues that come about on this, because in this case, this was clearly elder abuse. The salary that he was taking, he lost his job, which is one reason he was taking such a huge salary, but he was taking a good majority of his mom's income. She had enough to live on, but the excesses that used to go in the bank and savings that would be either for additional assets to support her in her remaining years, God forbid she'd have to go into a retirement home. But none of the other children were aware of this until one of them finally did find out about it and brought it to our attention, but he was the only trustee.
Yeah, we do see this. The child that is performing the successor trustee duties is entitled to a fee. However, that sounds like it could possibly be excessive. That's my first point. And the second point is the person that is acting in a trustee role is required by law, by probate law, to provide an annual accounting. So that accounting would show transactions and the assets in the trust, where everything went in and out. And it would have shown this child's salary and alerted the other siblings of the salary. So that is a very common problem that we run up against. So one good reason to have a professional fiduciary versus the child is it would eliminate a lot of the rivalry between the siblings, and that just causes disharmony in the family in the first place. So if they were to have named a professional trustee, that person would be the third party handling all of the finances, and they're locked up with that trustee. So any of the siblings coming to mom to ask for money, mom can always turn around and say, well, my professional trustee is handling the finances. Go to them, ask them for the money. And that puts the bullseye on our back, and that's what we're paid for. We're paid to be the third party, the impartial party, and take care of mom and sometimes ward away the children asking for money.
You know, in addition to the knowledge of all the things that have to be done in settling an estate, whether it's filing a 706 return, the income tax returns, keeping peace between family members, and sometimes you may have, let's say, daughter-in-laws, son-in-laws who may have undue influence in a particular situation. But let's talk about keeping that family peace, because a lot of times you don't know the true nature of, let's say, family life until all of a sudden money comes into a situation.
Right. That's very true. And even if the family members get along while mom and dad are alive, a lot of times when they pass away, things change. And they start squabbling over even personal effects besides the money. So if you have a third party that's neutral and they're not taking sides with any of the siblings, it just makes it smoother. It's a smoother transition and the estate can get wrapped up. Things can get done a lot faster because you've got somebody that's experienced and knows the next steps to take. So professional fiduciaries handle a lot of difficult situations like that. And it's one way to say, it's not my decision, it's the professional trustee's decision, go to them and talk to them about it.
What about the issue of providing financial guidance to a surviving spouse? Because, Tana, so many times we do find situations where one spouse took care of the finances, made the financial decisions, and all of a sudden, now this burden is thrust upon a surviving spouse with no experience in that background. And I can't tell you the number of times where I've seen surviving spouses being taken advantage financially by individuals in the industry selling product, putting, let's say, a surviving spouse into investments that are not appropriate. So let's talk about protecting a surviving spouse when there is not the financial knowledge to handle a large estate or assets.
Well, one way that professional fiduciaries handle that is they will do the bill pay for that surviving spouse, number one. So they will be in charge of making sure those bills are paid on time, tax estimates are made, property taxes are made, and they will do this a lot of times by changing the address for those particular vendors, the utility bills and things like that. Investment protection is professional fiduciaries. The private fiduciaries work with outside financial advisors. So we work with the team that's already in place. And we step into mom or dad's shoes talking about investments and through the professional trustee's communication with the surviving spouse, we can determine what the investment objective will be, whether a lot of income is needed or not needed, and we can work together with the financial advisor to help achieve her goals. And there's a lot more protection if you have that buffer zone. And professional trustees are experienced with financial advisors. They do have that background, and they've worked with them a lot. They've had the experience to understand a little bit more than possibly the surviving spouse who has not taken care of the investments during her lifetime.
Now, let's talk about something else. Because the tax laws have changed, the American Taxpayer Relief Act that came into play really clarified the exemption. It made it permanent. It also clarified the tax rates. So many of the trusts that were done before that, we talked earlier about the disclaimer trust that gives a surviving spouse the ability to choose whether to split the estate or not to split the estate. Let's talk about, Tana, let's say you are brought into a situation for whatever reasons, dementia or anything like that. Talk about the role that you may play with your knowledge working with not only the investment advisor, but also, let's say, the estate planning attorney that drew up the original documents to make sure that the plan is brought up to date and it fits the current circumstances of the family along with current tax laws.
When we are first involved in a situation, we do meet with the attorney. We sit down, we go over the trust document, and the attorney has usually notes and things in the file where they've met with the trustors. They understand what their intentions are. And we discuss that back and forth while at the same time going through the trust. Then once we take that piece, we work hand in hand with the tax preparer, the financial advisor, and the team that's in place at that time that has the history of the family.
So when you get involved in that and you execute it, talk about also situations that we often find, and sometimes we see this in estates where there's really a large estate and the original grantors of the trust are more interested in, let's say, creating a legacy, much like you see in some of the large families today, whether you're looking at the Kennedys or Rockefellers, where you're talking about generations of wealth that have been passed from one generation to the other. Let's talk about, let's say, siblings who may not be or have the capability, or let's say it's the wish of the grantor that they want to carry on a legacy for future generations, the role that the trustee plays in making sure that that happens, the assets are kept intact, the income needs are met of the beneficiaries, but also passing that legacy on for future generations.
So I've seen in the past where some trustors will include in their trust document a particular trust that's set up, and it involves the beneficiaries, whether it's the son or daughter, in selecting various, for example, charities, because possibly the trustors were very passionate about seniors or children for Children's Hospital. I've seen where they've involved the child in selecting the charity or some type of charity that fulfills the passion that the trustors had. So the trustee would be the chairman, for example, of the board, and the child would also be participating in actually determining how much you're going to give out. A scholarship fund. I had a trust one time that had scholarship funds that were to be doled out. So one of the family members would sit down with us and go through the applications. And it was a way that this particular husband and wife gave back to education and included the child in leaving that legacy.
So let's talk about, from your perspective, if you were talking to, let's say, a potential trustor in considering trustee services, what would you consider to be the chief advantage that one would consider, let's say, a successor trustee like yourself versus family members when looking at putting an estate plan together?
The number one thing I believe they should be looking at is the experience of that successor trustee. Look at their background and their training. Are they skilled to handle the difficulties that they're going to encounter as a successor trustee? And that's dealing with the financial assets, the real estate, the family dynamics, the different personalities. Is that particular person capable? Do they have the time to handle those type of issues that are going to come up? The second thing I think they need to really consider is if they're going to have a professional fiduciary, is that person licensed? professional fiduciaries are required to be licensed in the state of California if they have over so many trust accounts that they are acting in a trustee capacity for. And then the third thing would be, does the professional fiduciary have insurance? Just as a doctor or a dentist or a lawyer has malpractice insurance, they need to ask the question if the professional fiduciary has insurance. So errors and omissions insurance.
You know, something else that I was surprised to find out, I know if you have an estate that is large enough to be subject to, let's say, the estate tax rates, and you have to file a tax return or a 706 return, and that is due within 9 months of death. Just recently, I was going through some of the tax laws. I didn't realize, Tana, that the penalties for filing late are almost 5% of the tax due on a monthly basis, up to 25% of the taxes. I mean, that's a pretty stiff penalty. And you know this, you've seen it, especially the larger estates that are subject to estate taxes, whether it's a complex business, it's real estate holdings, large portfolios, art collection, all kinds of different assets. It takes time to not only appraise these things, get everything appraised, have the 706 return, so you know that. Talk about, this is something that is very important, and it's something that a successor trustee is very aware of those laws and can avoid those type of penalties.
Right, and that's a very important tax return, and it has to be timely filed. You're only allowed one extension, and yes, you have to go through a lot of hoops in order to get all the information together for the accountant or the attorney that's preparing the 706. So you have to work very closely hand in hand with them to provide the information that they're needing. Professional fiduciaries oftentimes know what that information is. They can communicate very easily with the accountant or the attorney preparing the death tax return. And working in a collaborative way like that, it can be accurately done and filed on time because a lot of attention is devoted specifically to that duty.
Well, I can tell you, Tana, over the years, I've been in this business 3 decades, and the thing that I've seen more than anything else, I've seen 2 issues that have come up, and they're more frequent. One is elder abuse with siblings, and the other one is that surviving spouses being taken advantage of because they did not understand, let's say, financial markets or the complexity of today's markets today, making financial decisions and being taken advantage by the financial industry. Tana, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the services of Pro Fiduciary, how can they do so, please?
Pro Fiduciary has a wonderful website, and it's right online. It's profiduciary.com, and that's profiduciary.com. We're located downtown in Little Italy at 444 West Beach Street, Suite 200 in San Diego, 92101. Or feel free to call our main line, and the telephone number is 619-501-4626. And we would be happy to meet with you. There's no charge, no obligation. We'd be happy just to go over what the estate plan is and if it's a good fit for us as being a successor trustee.
Tana, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. All the best to you, and come back and talk to us again.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Tana. That concludes this week's Lifetime Income Series. If you are in a situation, if you are a child listening to this program, you have elderly parents, or let's say you may be a spouse involved in an estate where you're not up to date on, let's say, the financial markets. One of the things that really disturbs me, and I'm seeing more and more of this, is elder abuse coming in today. And this is something that can be prevented. If you have children that are not responsible financially, or maybe you have a situation where you have spendthrift children or a spendthrift daughter-in-law, son-in-law, or there's maybe not peace between the different family members and agreement in terms of your estate planning wishes. If you fall into any of those situations, do yourself a favor. Get involved with a successor trustee, a professional that can handle the issues of income tax returns, 706 returns, making financial decisions to protect a surviving spouse either from elder abuse or financial mismanagement. You won't regret it, because we're seeing this more and more today come up in estate planning issues. It's a complex world out there, and you need a professional. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, once again, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a great week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.